He's a good doctor, I think, you know. I told him I get heartburn sometimes, so he goes and gets me a list of things that cause heartburn. I'm looking at the list and I'm like, I already know this. I know how to get it. That's like going into the hospital with a cannonball wound and they show you a list. Here's how you get cannonball wounds.
Are you all right, pal? You sure?
What kind of weird competitive freak are you?
It's a hormonal imbalance. Testosterone, the male hormone, dominates the female body. It's kind of scary. You come home, mommy, how you feeling?
Not bad today.
The beard's coming in nice.
You sure I'm worth it?
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that we were hoping that you'd help us with.
Yes. Like, where does the water go in the iron?
And what's the iron for?
And what gets out Kool-Aid stains?
Yeah, we already know that the opposite color Kool-Aid doesn't work.
Also, Troy scraped me when we were fork jousting last week, and I don't think it's healing right.
Oh, Abed, that's infected.
Infected, that's the word I was looking for.
She gets hot flashes and cold flashes. If she gets a hot flash and walks into a cold room, she can make it rain.
Sing along, Doc.
I think that's quite enough. You are a doctor after all.
Hospital food. Want some hospital food.
Rather esoteric beginning to the hour. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday house call. It's 10 after 3. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Last appearance on the Wednesday house call for a while.
For a little while, then back at the end of August.
You're having a little haul. Are you going anywhere? Or
yeah, I was going to leave town for a couple of weeks, okay. Just enjoy myself.
Recharge?
Yeah.
Get re-energized?
Absolutely.
Right. Every phone line is available if you have a health-related question, folks, at 521-TALK, *580, or 1-800-580-CFRA. From the Associated Press, It sounds like an unfolding epidemic. A decade ago, virtually no one in the United States seemed to have a problem eating gluten in bread and other foods. Now, millions do. Gluten-free products are flying off grocery store shelves and restaurants. Restaurants are boasting of meals with no gluten. Celebrities on TV talk shows chat about the digestive comfort that they blame on the wheat protein they now shun. Some churches even offer gluten-free communion wafers. Is it just another food fad? Faddishness is a big part of it. Americans will spend an estimated $7 billion this year on foods labeled gluten-free. But the best estimates are that more than half of the consumers buying these products, perhaps way more than half, don't have any clear-cut reaction to gluten. They buy gluten-free because they think it will help them lose weight, or because they think it makes them feel better, or because they mistakenly believe they are sensitive to gluten. What's going on here? Why do so many people want to avoid gluten? How many people do you think really suffer from celiac disease? This is what it was. This is what
it's
it
celiac
is, celiac disease,
yeah.
Right?
When you look at the information regarding the prevalence of the disease in various countries, in North America, it's 1 in 300 to 1 in 500. So in other words, Rob, in the United States, about 1 million people have it. And they're saying there are more than that that are going around buying these foods.
Well, it's a $7 billion industry.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of people who are either diagnosing themselves. People like to have a straightforward answer or sometimes a simple answer to complex problems and don't want to find out actually what the problems are, or they just don't want to go see their physician for a diagnosis. So there are very specific ways of diagnosing the disease. There are blood tests that are done, and there's also biopsies that are done that are pretty much conclusive with regards to diagnosing celiac disease. And celiac disease is called gluten enteropathy. It's where you are just not able to digest it very well. You react to that particular protein. It can cause cramps and diarrhea and weight loss, malabsorption, because it damages the intestine. And so you have very specific symptoms of that. However, lots of people get abdominal pain. Lots of people will get diarrhea. Lots of people will get cramps from time to time. And as with anything, a diagnosis has to be done systematically. You can't just go by initial symptoms and make a leap or assumption that that's what it is. There is a process that you go through to eliminate a list of potential conditions that can cause that. And I think that's what's being bypassed in this case.
Okay. So you have celiac disease and you have to go through a number of steps to make a proper diagnosis, right?
Right.
For celiac disease.
Correct.
What do you think about this rather vague term, gluten sensitivity?
Yeah, these are just sort of pseudoscientific type of terms that are being used to sell products.
Right. Like I have liberal sensitivity. Whenever I'm exposed to liberalism, I get irritable and cranky
right.
and short-tempered.
Right. It's a reaction to gluten. It is a you know, your body responds to the gluten. The intestine reacts. You get inflammation. You know, sensitivity. Sure, you can be sensitive to a lot of things, but that's not a diagnosis. Gluten sensitivity right. doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but I mean, you could have, because they say some of the problems for people who actually have celiac disease, abdominal pain, bloating, intermittent diarrhea.
Yeah,
right?
And lots of people can get that.
If I eat Big Macs for 30 days straight, mm-hmm. I'll probably get the same darn thing, but it does have anything to do with gluten.
Right. And there are other things. If you're dealing with a true malabsorption syndrome, that is, you can't absorb things from your intestine, you can't absorb nutrients from the food that you are consuming because of the damage that is being done to the intestine, you will see a lot of other things. So as I mentioned with the testing, Rob, you'll see potentially anemia because you can't absorb iron. You can't absorb, you lose weight. There's not enough protein being absorbed into your body. So iron deficiency, people get fatigued. You can potentially have vitamin D deficiency, calcium problems, all kinds of stuff that is seen with malabsorption syndromes, especially for children, failure to thrive, not growing, not following their growth curves. So you can't just say, I have celiac disease. What you can say is, I'm having symptoms that seem to be, and now we need to do the test to make sure that we're just not missing the boat, because the danger is if you misdiagnose and someone else has another problem and you've switched your diet around without clear evidence that you need to do so, you may be missing the boat on another illness that requires treatment.
Let me, you're going to get a kick out of this.
Sure.
Clearly, there are patients who are gluten sensitive, said Dr. Sheila Crow, San Diego-based physician on the board of American Gastroenterology Association. What is hotly debated is how many people have the problem, she added. It's impossible to know because the definition mm-hmm. is nebulous.
That's exactly it. It's a pseudoscientific term.
One of the most widely cited estimates comes from Dr. Alessio Fasano, a University of Maryland researcher who led studies that changed the understanding of how common celiac disease in the United States. He believes 6% of American adults have gluten sensitivity based on a review of patients at his clinic. Hardly a representative sample of the general public.
Right.
Whatever the number, the marketing of food without gluten has exploded. Those with celiac disease, of course, are grateful. Until only a few years ago, it was difficult to find grocery and dining options. It's a matter of keeping people safe, said Michelle Kelly, Atlanta area woman, yeah. who started a gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free, nut-free, well, that's debatable, nut-free bakery in 2010 after her son was diagnosed with celiac disease. At one of Atlanta's largest and busiest health food stores, Return to Eden, manager Troy DeGroff said over a third of his customers come in for gluten-free products for themselves or their families. Thank you, Elizabeth Hasselbeck, he said, referring to one of the hosts on the talk show, The View, who helped popularize gluten-free eating.
Yeah, this is, again, we're dealing now, the caveat to this and the exception to this is that they're, for those that truly have celiac disease, these comments that are coming up from me don't apply to them, right? So if you have celiac, I think it's great that all these products are out there. But the vast majority of people don't have. Again, the epidemiology is 1 in 300 to 1 in 500 people. So you have a lot of what we call the worried well, right? People that have some symptoms and they think they have some significant disease, they're otherwise healthy, and they're preyed upon by big business to sell this stuff. Sure, I think it's great to have all this stuff for people who have celiac because it improves their quality of life and they have food that they can eat and they don't feel like they're eating straw all the time. Right. So obviously I'm very happy about that. But I don't like the idea of preying upon people and promoting a particular disease as the cause celeb for a condition that may or may not exist for tens of millions of people and end up detouring the actual diagnosis of what they may have. And creating situations where they may not have any disease at all and they end up doing things that are not necessary except spending a lot of money where they don't have to, money that could be better applied to other food or other things to improve their quality of life. So this is no different than some of the other snake oil stuff that goes on with regards to people who don't have celiac disease.
Let's go to Greg in Ottawa. Greg.
Yeah, hi. I'm 57 years old, and about 14 months ago, I had my this question with respect to PSA levels.
Yes.
So, like I was saying, I had about 14 months ago, I had, just as part of an annual routine checkup, I'd never had a PSA test, so my doctor suggested I have one, and it was high. Well, it was 6.2.
Okay.
So he referred me to a specialist who said, you know, let's not worry about it. PSA levels fluctuate. Let's take another test in 6 months.
Okay.
Which I did, and it was down. It was like 2.4.
Right.
So he said, well, let's do another one at 6 months, and then if everything's okay, we'll wait for another year after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just recently had one a couple of weeks ago, and it was back, it was over 8.
Mm-hmm.
So my doctor, the urologist, is fairly laid back about it. He just wants to wait another 6 months again because he says they fluctuate fairly frequently.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, I've been reading up on it a bit, and I read about the PSA velocity, the difference between the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That could be something to look at. And I'm just wondering what your opinion would be on that. Should I just wait the other 6 months, or are we looking at any kind of biopsy or anything yet?
No, see, this is the problem with PSA testing, and this is why there's such controversy, because essentially when you look at the data, and these are on the basis of large studies. In fact, the recommendations in the U.S. now have come out against routine PSA testing unless there's a specific family history for prostate cancer.
Okay.
The issue is that for every approximately 1,400 healthy men that have a PSA test, 48 will have a PSA that's elevated. Of those 48, they will have either biopsies and other procedures and suffer the consequences of that, which can be not insignificant. That is, they can have pain afterwards, sexual dysfunction, bladder dysfunction, all kinds of things that happen from the biopsies. And you do all that on those 48, and you'll find one man who will have prostate cancer out of that 1,400.
Okay.
That from that one man, there really isn't much evidence to suggest, and this is from the New England Journal in March 2010, there isn't much to suggest that you are going to prolong that man's lifespan even from doing that test. The caveat to all of this, and the reason for mentioning this, is that, yes, you will have people that say, I had a PSA test, and it found a cancer, and it saved me. Yes, it will do that. But that's the person on the top of that iceberg.
Okay.
And then you have that 9/10 of the iceberg that's underwater that you don't see. Those are all the men that either have been damaged or who have had false positive tests, who have had things done to them, increasing their morbidity.
Okay.
So I think your urologist is probably quite correct in following this because it is fluctuating. It is going up and down.
Okay.
If there was a cancer per se, you wouldn't expect that level to vary so much. You'd expect it to continue to increase because cancers tend to, by nature of what cancers are, they grow. So you would expect the PSA level, for the most part, to go from, you know, when you were at 6.2, you really wouldn't expect it to go down to 2.4.
Gotcha.
Right? So it does vary. Also, PSA levels will vary if there's any inflammation of the prostate, if you have an enlarged prostate. Anytime 3 days after sexual activity, you can have elevated PSA levels. So it depends on the timing of the test as well.
Okay.
So all those things will go towards what we do with regards to a prostate cancer screening. It is a very contentious issue only because people like to have something to do in order to prevent the disease. The
right.
problem is the methods that we have today aren't the greatest, and it causes a lot of harm, which is what was why the recommendations in the U.S. say no routine screening for prostate cancer.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that answers my question.
You're very welcome, Greg.
Greg, good
All right,
luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to stop here, and we'll pick it up after the news. More of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA.
Doctors are good people. That's why they avoid the word pain. It's a buzzword. They won't hit it a lot. They don't want to scare anybody. Doctors will tell you all about pressure. They'll tell you all about the pressure you're going to experience. If a doctor tells you you're about to feel some pressure, buckle up. In a moment, you're going to feel a little bit of pressure. The pressure hurt like hell! Pressure. All pain involves pressure. That's one of the definitions of pain. He could be swinging a 2x4 at your head. In a moment, you're going to feel a little bit of pressure. Hey, bring it on. I'm good under pressure. I like pressure situations.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday house call on CFRA. And Sham, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Doctor,
yes.
Between having high blood pressure and low blood pressure, which is less harmful? First question. And I am having low blood pressure, doctor.
Well, the issue becomes one of whether there are any clinical effects of each of those. So, yes, for high blood pressure, obviously you're going to diagnosed hypertension, yes, is going to be quite harmful over the long term, leading to increased risk of heart disease, stroke, kidney problems, limb problems. Anywhere the arteries go, you're going to have an issue.
Okay.
Low blood pressure is only an issue if a person is fainting. That is, they just lose consciousness, or they fall over, they feel dizzy all the time. They feel like there's a black veil going across their eyes, almost about to faint. Those are symptoms of low blood pressure, where the body is not able to pump blood effectively to the brain. The pressure is too low to do that. But if someone has low pressure, and again, low pressure can really mean anything. It can be low pressure could be 100 over 80. It could be 90 over 60. It could even be 70 over 40. But really what we're concerned about is whether someone has symptoms with that. If they have no symptoms and they're functioning normally and they have a lower blood pressure, that's fine. There's nothing you would do to change anything because the person is not being harmed. If, on the other hand, someone is having low blood pressure and having symptoms, then you would do an evaluation to make sure if there's anything going on with the heart, if there's any arrhythmias, if there's anything, any other diseases that could potentially cause one of the symptoms being low blood pressure. So again, it always has to be taken in context with the clinical effect of the condition.
I see. Okay. So in my case, I take 3 medication: mm-hmm. Coversil, Norvasc, and Metoprolol.
Right.
Now, I'm on this for the last about 15 years. Mm-hmm. Now, in this heat, my blood pressure when I take is about 120 mm-hmm. over 50, mm-hmm. And pulse rate is about 55. Now, and I feel the other thing that you explained, I have those symptoms, a little bit dizziness, and I get up, and totally lethargic, and I can't, you know, suddenly feel a bit, vision is a bit mm-hmm. blurry and things like that.
Now, when that happens, does mm-hmm. that happen and last only for about 30 seconds to a minute, or does that continue throughout the day?
No, it doesn't continue, it just suddenly, you
okay.
know, yes.
So what you're having, and again, 120 over 50 is not really low blood pressure. The 120 is actually normal. The 50 is a little bit low, but nothing that we would do much about. It's the okay. 120 that's more of an issue, which is okay. But you're on blood pressure medication. So one of the issues is that when your body changes positions, that is when you go from, say, lying down to standing up or okay. from sitting to standing very quickly, what happens is that there are pressure changes in your vasculature, in your circulatory system. So when you go from sitting to standing, especially if it's very warm outside, your blood vessels are already dilated. And so when you stand up, your pressure temporarily will drop. And that happens with everybody. That's part of what happens when we change body positions. The issue is how quickly the body recovers from that. And there is, your body has what's known as an autonomic nervous system. That is, it functions by itself. It doesn't, there's nothing that you do to change it, and it will accommodate. So if your pressure drops, it will automatically sense the drops in pressure because there are pressure sensors that are called baroreceptors in our vasculature, and it will tell the heart to speed up. It will tell the arteries to constrict a bit and increase pressure to the brain. Usually that happens literally within a few seconds. But for people that are on blood pressure medications, people that are older, the system tends to slow down. And as a result, you tend to feel a bit more dizzy, where it could take half a minute to a minute before you attain a normal state again. But these are not necessarily disease states. It's simply a slowdown of the body's response. And in this case, with the medications that you're taking, especially with metoprolol will slow your heart rate.
Okay.
And so your heart is not going to be able to speed up as quickly as someone who's not on metoprolol. And as a result, you can't increase your pressure as quickly. in situations that way. But it's still not dangerous as long as you accommodate, as long as you know that if you're going to change position, you may get a bit dizzy. You just have to change body position a bit more slowly instead of just suddenly standing up, or when you're lying down, suddenly getting up and standing up. So it's just a matter of giving your body a little bit more leeway, a little bit more of a buffer in terms of time to adjust to those changes.
So, Doctor, thank you so kindly for your explanation. Now I'm a bit chill, so now I know exactly what's going on. So I was a bit concerned because it's very difficult to get to a doctor, and I feel bad to go to a doctor because of the time and all that. So I thought, oh, I might get your opinion, and so it has cleared my anxiety. Thank you so kindly.
I'm glad to help.
Let's move along to Jerry in Ottawa. Jerry.
Hello, Dr. Dawkins.
Hi.
I've been diagnosed with MDS.
Right, so myelodysplastic syndrome.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, on the weekend, I was in the hospital for a blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
And when, which was fine, there was about 12 of us in there, I think. When we were in there, they came around with something called Ensure before we left and said, well, they didn't give it to us, said, would you like to try it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard you saying a lot of these things don't do any good for anybody. And I'm just wondering two things. Will Ensure taking it do anything to my condition? And do you know anything about Ensure?
Well, Ensure is simply a dietary supplement that's usually given to people who are having difficulty either getting enough calories during the day, having difficulty consuming solid food for various reasons, could be intestinal problems. Some people who have severe illness, cancers, for example, where they're feeling very weak and they can't eat very much. So you're trying to give them not only calories, but the proteins, carbohydrates, and fiber and other nutrients that they can lack because of their disease, because it's just prohibiting them from consuming that.
So that's not really going to do any harm to me.
It's not going to do any harm. There's no harm in consuming it. It's not something that, you know, for the average person to go out and drink, because if you're eating well, you don't really need it. It's, you know, for myelodysplastic syndrome, for just our listeners, it's a disease where the stem cells in the bone marrow are damaged. And so people end up with anemias, they end up with infections because they can't make enough of the cells, white blood cells as well. So they, you get, in this case, I guess you got the transfusion and you got a replacement for the cells that you had lost.
Yes. The other thing too is I was on candesartan for high blood, blood pressure.
Right.
Quite a while back. And since I got this problem, they've taken me off that completely and said, don't take it because it's not doing any good. It was bringing down my blood pressure.
Right.
It was, high. But taking it now wouldn't do anything for me. So I'm not taking any blood pressure because my blood pressure is usually very low anyhow.
Right, and exactly. I mean, again, you don't want to be taking a medication if there's no clear indication for it anymore.
Yeah.
So how are you doing anyway? How are you feeling?
I have good days and bad days. If that sounds makes any
sense. Well, no, that makes a lot of sense. Sure.
And I find when I have the blood pressure, which I had on the weekend, blood transfusion. This week I felt very good.
Yeah, because you're able to circulate a bit of oxygen around your body now.
Yes, right.
I'm glad to hear that you're feeling a bit better. But you also raise a very good point, and we've brought this up before, Rob, with regards to chronic disease.
Yes.
Where people will say, some days are good, some are bad. And this goes to what we were talking about in the past, earlier on the show and before, how you will have people and businesses out there take advantage of those that are suffering. And one of the concepts behind chronic disease is that people do feel better from time to time. And when they feel worse, they're more likely to try something different. But as with anything, you feel worse, but you'll get better anyway. You'll feel better from time to time, and a lot of times they associate that with whatever they've taken when it's not really the case. And so you get people giving them all kinds of concoctions saying, this is going to help you, and lo and behold, they feel a bit better, but they feel a bit better only because they're having their natural cycle of having good days and bad days.
Liz, you're up next. Liz.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling about the low blood pressure. I've had well, not just the feeling dizzy and the blanket of black that comes across. Mm-hmm. That I've been taking Flurinef, and it takes away that blackout, but I still get dizzy. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the other symptoms. At the same time, I just can't breathe. I have to take deep, deep breaths and put it out, push it out really fast. Mm-hmm. And my heart just be like, even though I'm in shape, and even when I was in the best physical shape, I'd go up a flight of stairs, and I've got to plop my body down on the bed because my heart's just beating, and I feel like I can't hold my body up. Mm-hmm. So it really limits me. When I'm shopping, I end up having to come home because just looking up makes me dizzy, and I find it very hard to hold my body up. Is that familiar to you at all?
Well, what you're describing doesn't sound very much as a result of blood pressure problems.
No way.
Now, you're taking Flurinef, which is a steroid. Is it for any specific condition?
It was. For the low blood pressure. Like, I was never lower than 90 over 60, I don't think. But it's just whenever I would look up or bend down and get up, which was worse, I would have that blanket of black.
So when was this last evaluated with regards to the Flurinef? Are you being followed for it?
No, this is 20 years ago I was put on it.
Yeah.
And I did see an endocrinologist just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And... she said everything looked fine
All right, so then that's fine. But if you're having moving your head and feeling dizzy, there are a lot of things that have to be done, because if you're losing balance or feeling off balance, you lift your head, you're feeling dizzy, it can be what we call your vestibular system, which is your balance organs. Something may be wrong with that. It still can be side effects from the Flurinef. You've been on it for 20 years. It is a steroid. It can certainly have that effect over time. So what I would say is that, again, I wouldn't make the assumption that it's just blood pressure.
Yeah.
I would probably see your family doctor, mention all these symptoms, and then systematically what has to happen is we have to go through all those things. So a neurological assessment if you're feeling dizzy, checking the ears, checking your balance organs. There's other stuff that needs to be done in order to evaluate this. It's not normal for you to be having your heart beating that fast, having to go home after shopping. There's something that is not working properly, and I think it's more than just blood pressure.
Well, that's what I keep telling my doctor. It's been since 1990 I've been going to the doctor about this. And what should I request then? Because I haven't been getting any help.
Well, if you're having the dizziness, moving your head and feeling dizzy, it can be a neurologist is one of the people to see.
Okay.
That would be a first step. Cardiology assessment, if you're feeling your heart is beating too quickly.
And if the government will allow you to have one.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, that was a problem just now with my doctor. I really had to convince him to get a particular test.
You know, again, you're suffering with something. There's no answer yet. It's not good enough to say, well, there's nothing. You then have to go to the various specialists to rule various areas of your body that could be causing this, rule that out, and move from one thing to another until we find something.
Good luck, Lise. Thanks for coming in.
You're
right
out
of time. Are you here on Sunday?
No, I will not be here on Sunday.
You're hitting the road.
Hitting the road.
All right. Have a great holiday. It's well deserved.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call here on CFRA. Dr. Yoni Friedhoff is going to be filling in for Dr. Dworkin while he's away. So he'll be here next Wednesday and talk about weight loss and fitness and all that good stuff. Looking forward to that as well.